Judiciary Committee to order. Today we have a full house on our public hearing and possible, well, we're just going to have a public hearing today on Senate Bill 435. We also have a work session scheduled for Senate Bill 965. It's highly unlikely that that is going to be dealt with. If there's anybody here in the audience on 965, please contact Dale over here and let them know that you're here and interested in this. This will most likely get passed over to the next day, and if there's somebody in here who came especially for it, I'd want to know that because we will accommodate that. So we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 435, and the way we are going to proceed on this is we are going to have a brief presentation by legislators who are here to talk on this. We have an informational panel on the issues in Senate Bill 435, and then we're going to start off by a 15-minute panel from the proponents of this bill, and then we will follow with 15 minutes from the opponents of this bill, the primary people who have been interested in this bill. And then we will, for the rest of the hearing, we will alternate between proponents and opponents until we hopefully get through this hearing. So for the audience, the shorter you can keep your comments, the more people will be able to testify on your side of the issue. And I want to avoid specific time limits if I can, but if I need to, as we progress, I will put on time limits. So with that, we will start with two legislators we have here, Representative Shields and Representative Hansen. Welcome to the committee. However you guys want to work it out.
Okay. Thank you, Adam.
But not together.
Okay. A duet.
We're using two completely different sheets of paper, so we won't have to, we won't be in duet. I'm Gary Hansen. I'm state representative from House District 44. And I'm here to testify in favor of the legislation, and I'm doing that from the perspective of a Ways and Means Public Safety Committee member. For the last three sessions, I've worked on our public safety budgets. Last session, we were about $88 million short of funding a complete public safety system that actually worked. We went to the co-chairs and the legislature added money back, got us to that point where we had a workable system, but much of that was lost with the failure of Measure 30. Now we're looking at a system that's underfunded by, my guess is, about $60 million. If we do nothing now, we are going to be in the next decade having to finance and build 5,000 additional prison beds. With the resources that the state has now and what we're likely to have in the future, that is going to be an incredible struggle. So my point, and it's real simple, is we need to start taking actions now in order to try and control the costs so that we can afford to fund a complete public safety system, that we're not disproportionately funding corrections over transitional services, over law enforcement. Before I came to the legislature, I was a county commissioner for Multnomah County. Multnomah County is currently struggling with out being able to fund adequate local jail beds, local law enforcement officers. The point is, we have to look at a comprehensive system of public safety, and that system has to be sized properly to the amount of resources the state of Oregon has. This bill, I think, is one of the first steps towards getting us to that correct staging so we can have a sustainable, so we can finance a sustainable public safety system. And with that, I will close and be open for any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative of District 43, North Northeast Portland, the district that I believe has more inmates returning to it than any other district in the state. Inmates returning to crime is an incredibly, incredibly important issue in my district. Before I jump into my testimony, I'm also been asked to provide the testimony of the Citizens Crime Commission. They did not take a complete position on this bill, but they did write, while the full commission has not fully analyzed Senate Bill 435, and this has not formally endorsed it, the Citizens Crime Commission fully endorses the concepts embodied in Senate Bill 435. In short, we support shifting funds from corrections to prevention and intervention programs for young people, and et cetera. So my staff is going to pass around their testimony for the record.
Thank you. We will put it in the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I don't really see why this bill should be very controversial. We tried to make it very moderate. We knew that the district attorneys and certain crime victims organizations would get upset about any bill that tried to find some cost savings in Measure 11. We understood that. So in this bill, we put Measure 11 aside and said, how can we obtain some real cost savings out of non-Measure 11 offenses in ways that would protect public safety and allow us to reinvest in community corrections, law enforcement, treatment, K-12, Head Start, housing for the elderly, etc. Now, this bill simply says, let's set Measure 11 aside and let's increase earned time from 20% to 33% for non-Measure 11 offenders. Now, this bill, applied prospectively, as will be done with amendment, affects offenders who opponents of Senate Bill 435 have stated are not the worst offenders. The most important aspect of earn time is its predictive nature. Those who behave inside are much more likely to behave outside. Claudia Black will be summarizing the study of earn time conducted by Dr. Ben DeHaan, who most of you know is the former Oregon Department of Corrections Director. And some opponents will be sure to criticize the study, and I understand why they need to do so. But let's talk about what are other states doing on earn time. Well, in Washington State, last session, they had less of a prison funding crisis than we have today. And their legislature approved a maximum of 50% earned time, depending on offense and other factors associated with risk to reoffend. 50%. Now, the results of Washington's earned time expansion to 50% is on page 4 of my testimony. 2,095 inmates were released after earning up to 50% earned time credits between July 2003 and February 2005. Only 34 of the 2,095 have been returned to prison for new crimes that occurred in that window before the date the inmate would have been released under their prior policy, which was 33% maximum earn time prior to July 2003. 34 of 2,095. And all but one of the 34 were drug or property offenses, and one was for harassment. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we can build off of Washington's success. So why do we need to move on this now? Well, Representative Hansen exhibited why we need to move on this now. And I felt it was important to move on this bill this session now because as I watched the output of the interim committee charged with reforming sentencing, I was disappointed that all of the ideas that they came up with actually increased sentences and actually cost more money, I think with one exception. And the irony here today is that just about every government group that will come here in opposition is looking for more money for their budgets. When you ask them how we'll come up with that extra money, they'll say, well, that's not our job. And they're right, it's not their job. It's ours. And we've got to do something about prison growth. Everyone, including DOC Director Max Williams, agrees we've got to do something. You'll hear a lot about truth in sentencing today, and I'm all for that. The amendments to this bill declare that this bill would only operate prospectively with the earned time percentage pronounced clearly in open court. But today, we need not only to talk about truth in sentencing. I say to you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we also need to talk about truth in budgeting. It's clear that the corrections budget is eating far too much of the rest of the Oregon State budget. We need to acknowledge that and begin to slow the growth of our prison system. And I think this bill essentially boils down to a few questions. One is, are we okay with spending $1.2 billion on prisons now and $2.4 billion on corrections in 2013? $2.4 billion. Question two is, should we prioritize our bed space for the worst, highest-risk offenders? I believe the public wants us to focus limited bed space on the worst offenders. And three, and perhaps the most important question is this: if not this moderate non-Measure 11 bill, then what? What would the opponents of this bill propose instead? And if not this session, Madam Chair, then when? Now, Madam Chair, I know we all believe we've got to find solutions to these questions. Let's start by passing Senate Bill 435. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In Washington State, the earned time, you said, went clear up to 50%, and yet the recidivism so far has been quite low, according to your testimony. What do you attribute that? I mean, do they have some kind of a particularly effective screening process, or how have they managed to achieve that?
They do. I think they owe their success to a couple of things. One is the predictive nature of earned time, and two is to make sure you have a validated assessment tool, and I think the state of Washington has a good one.
Transferable?
It is. And I think you also need to have solid programs. One of the downsides of building so many prisons is that we're watering down programming. We're cutting, I believe it's from $8 to $2 million on drug and alcohol treatment, effective evidence-based programs. And that's just a natural course of things. If you're going to build prisons, eventually you're going to get to the point where you have to cut effective drug and alcohol treatment.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I want to thank both of you for bringing the bill forward today. I think your leadership in this area is very important. My understanding is that Oregon is in the top five states in the country on per capita spending on prisons. And I'm wondering whether you have any information as to how that correlates, whether it makes us more safe. Does it lead to more safety on the streets?
Well, Oregon has a significantly higher incarceration rate than the state of Washington. We're at about, I think, 340 per 100,000, and I believe in Washington, just off the top of my head, they're at around 260. So I guess the question is, when you drive across the river, are you less safe? Do you feel less safe? We do spend a lot of money on corrections, and I think the main reason is that we lock people up. We don't necessarily lock up more people, but we lock them up for longer periods. And I think every policy that we have should increase public safety and save taxpayer dollars from here on out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Other questions? Thank you very much for coming. Next, we will move into our informational panel, which is Claudia Black, Sue Porter, and Craig Prinz.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. We haven't had any direction on how you wanted to proceed. It's my job for the members of the committee the Criminal Justice Commission helps shepherd fiscals for a legislative fiscal office because a legislative fiscal office is... they are accountants, so they're used to finding out the budget principles, and sometimes when they look at a criminal bill, they need someone to help them to work with the agencies and to understand the assumptions that they should make in going into it. They rely to a great deal, and we all do, on Sue Porter, who helps do the forecast for corrections out of the Office of Economic Analysis. And so we look at this together. And I wanted to make it clear to the committee, Mr. O'Leary gave us a couple of the assumptions that this was to be based on. My understanding is we do have an amendment to that effect. The key ones were that this would only affect people who are going to be sentenced on or after this date. It would not be applied retroactively. The other thing that we wanted to make sure we understood was we get sentences imposed at that point, not for crimes that affected on or after that date. Those are the two things that Mr. Leary clarified for us when we put together the fiscal. The third assumption that I think is important, which basically in how we do a fiscal, I think is Ms. Porter works on with her forecasting and then gives it back to Department of Corrections to say, okay, if there's this big an impact on prison population, what would be the financial impact of that? My understanding, and I am no mathematician, is that we use the same ratio. So if 20% was the maximum, and is the current maximum for earn time, and then the per prisoner, they earn something less than that, which I'm not exactly sure what that is. When talking to Mr. O'Leary, we said we wanted to use that same ratio. So the same ratio that inmates earned, good time would be applied with a new ratio. And I gave to Mr. O'Leary our understanding of what the impact would be. So with that, we can try to answer questions to the best of our abilities.
Senator Kosansky.
Greg, do you have something for us? And since it's something hard copy that we can look at?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, because... Joe, I don't know if the amendments came in late, so they did not go to legislative fiscal because legislative fiscal wanted to make sure that they understood what the assumptions were for when this would be enacted. So I don't think you have something from legislative fiscal, but I think Department of Corrections has done its work with from the forecast of what Ms. Porter works from. So we do have information on an estimate.
Yeah, this is a problem we run into from time to time where we don't have the official legislative fiscal, but we have figures that will go into it. That doesn't mean that they'll come out that way.
That's correct.
But we have kind of a ballpark, and maybe, Council, you could just summarize what the ballpark figures are here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And Mr. Prince is correct. The -2 amendment, which is the amendment in your packet, clarifies that the measure applies prospectively. It inserts an emergency clause and says that the greater reduction level, maximum reduction level, is applicable to sentences imposed after that date. And the material that I received from Mr. Prince that I believe was forwarded to LFO indicates a savings effect, total savings effect for 2005-2007 of $6,500,096,263. And then for 2007-2009 biennium, $23,075,340. There's a breakdown by bed and by payments to local counties and community supervision that I'm happy to forward. And Mr. Borden, who is probably feverishly working on the fiscal statement as we speak,
right.
I advised him because the amendment came in late, he didn't get the amendment until just
right.
today, I advised him that he should take his time and get it right rather than rush the final statement up to us.
I'm sure I assume that Rhodes are going to get something at some point in writing that we can actually digest and hold
we
on
will.
To.
We will. Okay. And as Council pointed out, we had an amendment put in which will basically reduce the fiscal benefits, but as the best estimate we have now, which is not a final estimate, is roughly $6 million for the next biennium and $23 million after that. And, of course, that's because it couldn't go into effect until sentences imposed after the measure goes into effect.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And we just wanted to make sure we had those right assumptions. And, so that's why we're here, to make sure if there's something that we need to clarify that for those assumptions, then we need to look at it. One of those, I mean, to my mind, the key one is the rate at which inmates actually earn time. You know, a judge can say in a sentencing after a trial or in a plea agreement, you know, this inmate is not eligible for earned time. Corrections has their way, and my understanding is it's fairly it's difficult. I mean, they have to calculate this. So our assumption was that it would be the same rate. But to make it clear that, you know, the judge doesn't always allow for earned time, and this would be based upon inmate behavior being about the same as what it is. Mm-hmm. And then we just took that, and when I say we, I mean, you know, I didn't do any of the math. I'm just trying to help with the assumptions. And so that's what we try to do. And so we're here to just see if there's something that you else that you want us to do, we'd be happy to try to do that.
Okay. Maybe you or Ms. Porter could answer the question of what that ratio is, the ratio of earned time to...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name's Suzanne Porter with the Office of Economic Analysis. The numbers that you have as far as headcount, those are taken, what's the impact on our April 1 forecast, our brand new forecast? When we do that forecast, we look at, as far as length of stay, we look at a group of inmates, say the last couple of years of inmates, and how long did they stay and what was their earnings. So we take that same group of people and look at the percentage of time each one earned. Some earned all that was available, some earned none of what was available, some earned 80% of what was available. Whatever that group earned, we just raised the cap. So now
what was the ratio? That's, do you know what
overall, I did not look at that for everyone. I've heard in the past, this is several years ago, I had heard that on average they earned 16%, but I think there's people here that have more current information.
If you could find that information, let us know. There have been a lot of changes in the Department of Corrections since several years ago, so we would need very recent figures to make any sense. Thank you. Are you done with your presentation, Mr.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Did you want to speak or did you want to move to Claudia?
I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Black.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Claudia Black, and I am the Interim Director of the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute at Portland State University. And I'm here today to present information on an analysis that the Institute performed to identify factors associated with recidivism and to identify those inmates most likely to recidivate. And just to clarify, the definition that we're using for recidivism is a conviction of a new felony within 3 years of release from prison. And as Representative Shields said, Ben DeHaan, the former director of the Institute, has been working with these data for several months. I am new to them. He's accepted a position in Seattle and was unable to make the hearing today. So any questions that you may have that I cannot answer, which is very likely, we'll be happy to respond to in writing. This analysis builds on the previous work of the Department of Corrections, which was to determine which inmates were most likely to recidivate, but this analysis uses more historical and demographic variables and a more sophisticated analysis. The Department of Corrections asked the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute to undertake this study in an effort to target those limited resources for programming to the inmates who were most likely to recidivate. The analysis included inmates eligible for earned time who were released from Department of Corrections prisons between 1995 and 2000, and there were 8,253 inmates who were followed for 3 years post-release. The analysis incorporated variables that were used in the previous Department of Corrections studies as well as variables identified in the literature as possibly affecting recidivism. So we looked at the following variables: age, previous theft conviction, prior incarceration, earned time. You might explain that earned time is up to a 20% reduction of a sentence for good behavior within the institution and program participation while in prison, sentence length, type of crime, and revocations. We also looked at the combinations of these variables to see if there were interactive effects. The analysts used Cox regression, and this is an important thing to realize because it's a very sensitive tool, also known as proportional hazards regression, to relate inmate characteristics with recidivism. So these were our findings. First of all, it's important to note that approximately 75% of inmates in this study did not get a new felony conviction within 3 years of release. So the other 25...
I'm sure.
Senator Brzezinski.
Can you give us clarification? You say from release. Are we talking about release from the facility, or are we talking about after they're off of, in this case, parole?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, released from prison. And so that leaves 25% who were not who were convicted of a new felony within 3 years of release. So these findings of this particular study focus on the following variables: earned time, offender age, and sentence length. The relationship between recidivism and sentence length is more pertinent to other legislation being proposed than this. Ben DeHaan has offered to present on sentence length at a future date on the other bill if that's something that the committee desires. So my testimony is going to focus on earned time credit and offender age as it relates to this bill. What we found is that inmates who with more earned time are more likely to recidivate. Inmates with more earned time are less likely to recidivate. Stated differently, those who behave well in prison are likely to behave well when they are released into the community. For example, a 20-year-old inmate with 0% earned time credit is 56% more likely to have a new felony conviction within 3 years of release than a 20-year-old with 20% earned time credit for good behavior and programming. Recidivism is very much related to age. Younger inmates are more likely to recidivate, and the relationship between age and recidivism is strongest with inmates less than 35 years of age. A 20-year-old inmate is 2.7 times more likely to recidivate than a 35-year-old. The relationship between earned time and recidivism is also much stronger for younger inmates. As I mentioned before, younger inmates with little earned time are much more likely to recidivate than younger inmates who earn the maximum credit of 20%. But by the time you reach age 5, it's a less useful predictor of which inmates will recidivate. Relationship between earned time and recidivism seems to be curvilinear. And for those of you, or which was a fairly new term as it was for me, means it starts out here and it's gradually moving down in a curved line. The more earned time, the less likely an inmate is to recidivate. We could only test this relationship to the maximum of 20% earned time credit because that's all that an inmate can earn in Oregon prisons. However, it is possible that recidivism rates could drop further with higher levels of earned time credit. As I mentioned before, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, but any I can't answer, we'd be happy to present in writing. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Chip Black. In your text here, it points out that 20-year-old inmates are 2.7 times more likely to recidivate than 35-year-old. But how long has that 20-year-old been in prison? I mean, how's that, you know, if they're... Assuming they weren't put in prison as a juvenile and you're not crossing over here, they could only have been in prison for 2 years for the study.
Senator Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, that gets more into the realm of sentence length, which I'm not prepared to discuss today, but I'd be happy to take your question back and get a response for you.
I would appreciate that because to me that just jumps off the page. That, you know, what basis do we have to determine in a maximum of 2 years incarceration as compared to the other longer sentencing deal?
Senator Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, my understanding is that the variables, they held constant for those variables in doing this study, so that should have been factored in, but I will definitely get back and respond to you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Senator Brzezinski.
Claudia, I think following up on what Senator Whitsitt asked, I'm going to just ask you regarding this, the data that was brought to us from Representative Shields on the Washington State. I don't know if Mr. DeHaan and his research or at the school, if there was any discussion as to looking and doing some type of cross-check referencing compared to other states that may have extra or additional provisions for a higher return on recidivism. Regarding the amount of time that they can get for earned time. Since they currently were at 33 and just last year went to 50%, I'd like to know if there's been any cross-checking as to validation as to what we're relying on, and I'm not sure if our study that you're presenting today, if this is related to only the Oregon Department of Corrections, or if this is a broader field of study in the sense of institutions that could be included.
Senator Burdick, Senator Prezonsky, this information that I presented today is only for the Department of Corrections data, and I recently heard of the work that they've done in the Washington Public Policy Institute and would be happy to look into that and follow up with it. And I'd be happy to get you a copy of it as well if that would be helpful.
That'd be great.
Thank you. Senator Byer.
Thank you. Two questions. Claudia, did you have any information on the ratio of earned time? The question about asked earlier, what that ratio is?
Senator Burdick, Senator Byer, my understanding from this study, which is the most recent one, was that it was between 16% and 17% earned time credit. From 2 years ago, if you'd be interested, 34.8% earned less than 10%, 25.1% earned between 10% and 14.9%. 21.2% earned between 15% and 19.9%, and 20.1% earned a full 20%. However, our most recent study shows that 61% earned 20% earned time.
So I'm trying to can you get us that information? I'm trying to normalize. So 61% earned the maximum. Is that what you just said?
Correct.
Mr. Prince, do you want to...
Madam Chair, and one of the things I think I want to check on with that is I want to see, like I said, some people are not eligible for earned time, so we need to make sure and see, you know, are the ones that are not eligible, are they in the group? So we'll make sure and get those ratios so we can look at all inmates, and then for those who are eligible for the up to 20%, what percentage of them get 20%, or what's the average? We'll make sure and do that.
Okay. Can I
if you've got another comment on that, because I'm going somewhere else.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to clarify, this study only focused on all the inmates who were eligible for earned time credit.
Okay, so those are 60%, because a judge excludes some from even consideration.
Then they would not have been in our pool. These were the inmates who were actually eligible, and 61% earned the full amount.
Okay. Thank you. I guess this is more of a comment than a question, but I'd be happy to hear your response to it. But it seems like basic logic, your results of your study, is that people who earn more good time credit are less likely to recidivate. Well, that's basic logic. They were the better people. They were less bad. So they were less likely to reoffend. I mean, it just seems like basic logic.
Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of the bill, Senator Byer, is figuring out who those people are so you can move them out of the beds and move somebody else in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it does seem logical.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, now we will start with our panels, and I have this fancy watch here, and I'm going to start my timer, and however much time this first panel takes will be given to the second panel as well. So we will start our first panel of advocates for the bill, Bridget Sarabi, John Topagna, and Cynthia Geyer. Welcome, all of you, to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Bridget Sarabi, and I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 435. I'm the Executive Director of the Western Prison Project, a regional nonprofit organization that works for safe and sensible criminal justice policies that can save taxpayer dollars, reduce recidivism, and keep the public safe. As a survivor of a serious and violent crime, I assure you we take public safety very seriously. And as the mother of a formerly incarcerated woman who successfully returned to the community, I am here to support this bill as a moderate and reasonable response to controlling costs of corrections and reducing future crime. As you know, Senate Bill 435 would expand the possibility of earned time sentence reductions from 20% to 33% for those new prisoners who would be eligible for earned time under current statutes. These will be people who are convicted of the least serious charges people can be sent to prison for, things like minor assault, burglary, theft, and drugs. Don't get me wrong, I do not mean to imply that these are not serious offenses. They are. But let's be clear, this bill expands earned time only for those new people coming into the system whose crimes are under the threshold of Measure 11. It is the most moderate reform we can make and still have a significant fiscal impact. The primary objective of Senate Bill 435 is to save tax dollars in a responsible way by making it possible to increase early release for lower-level offenders who have shown a commitment to rehabilitation. The question for the committee to ask themselves is, if not this legislation, then what strategies can we adopt to reduce the unsustainable growth of our prison system? As has been pointed out, earned time is not automatic. It is up to the Department of Corrections to award earned time based on an individual's behavior while incarcerated. We can assume that only those individuals who show a real commitment to rehabilitation would be awarded the full 33% earned time this bill would authorize. According to some of the figures that I looked at from the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute, a full quarter of Oregon prisoners currently eligible for 20% are receiving 15% earned time or less. Clearly, the DOC has the authority and the will to deny earned time to prisoners who are not making a sincere effort at rehabilitation. This is a very moderate bill that would save millions of dollars. In fact, many millions more than I thought. The original figures we had from the Department of Corrections suggested that this bill would save $16 million in the next 4 years. Now we hear today that it will save approximately $30 million. In addition, it will save 400 to 500 prison beds. That's the size of our newest prison, which costs taxpayers $30 million in construction costs and how much more in debt service. These are significant savings. There are, of course, folks who would argue against expanding earned time. Some may believe that it sets us on a path that would jeopardize public safety. Many of these folks work within the system, and I understand that it's their role to advocate for funding for their areas of responsibility, just as it is the role of school administrators and others to advocate for education funding, for health and human services funding. The truth is we cannot fund everything at the desired level and must look at responsible ways to economize. So I urge you to take a look at this bill with an open mind and a sense of the fiscal constraints the state is facing. Many, many other critical needs in Oregon are going unmet, and yet the corrections budget continues to grow significantly. This is a modest and responsible way to begin to slow that growth. I've attached to my testimony two handouts. One is a handout on managing the prison population responsibly and reducing the growth rate. Another is a report by Judy Green, a nationally known criminal justice researcher, on crime trends and incarceration rates in Oregon. I'm also submitting written testimony from three of our members who could not be here to give verbal testimony today. One is a representative from Crime Survivors for Community Safety, another is a law enforcement professional, and another is a doctor from Southern Oregon who couldn't make the trip up today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm John Tapponia. I'm a managing director of Echo Northwest, a Portland-based economic consulting firm. Economics, like legislative policymaking in the state, is primarily concerned with the allocation of scarce resources. And during the past decade, Oregonians have placed a growing share of scarce resources into the corrections area. Now, after a decade, it's appropriate and necessary that policymakers and citizens step back and consider whether the current policy path is sustainable and whether we could achieve the same goals more cost-effectively. I'll speak briefly on each point using this handout. On this handout, on the side that has the table reading Oregon State and Local Government Expenditures 1991-92 to 2001-2002, you'll see spending trends in all sectors of Oregon government, both at the state and local level. And you'll see highlighted there that in the corrections area between 91-92 and 2001-2002, per capita spending for every man, woman, and child in the state of Oregon increased from $106 on corrections in 1991-92 to $235 per capita in 2001-2002. That translates into an 8.3% annual average growth rate each year, 8.3%. Using the same data source, the census, the Cascade Policy Institute recently estimated that Oregon ranks fifth nationally on correction spending per capita and spends 26% more on corrections and police combined than you would expect given our demographic profile and our income levels. 8% annual growth is not sustainable in a state that is committed to living within its means, that has a constitutionally enacted kicker, and that is considering spending limits going forward, possibly. Senate Bill 435 is a modest first step at balancing the state's dual goals of public safety and fiscal responsibility. On the backside, I'd also like to draw your attention to an analysis that was done in the late 1990s by the RAND Corporation, which I think would be a model for public safety policymaking going forward. In this 1998 analysis, RAND looked at a variety of early interventions, including parental training for young children that were acting out, graduation incentives for high school-age children, and delinquent supervision for teenagers, and compared them to the cost-effectiveness of the state's three-strikes incarceration policy. Showed that in three of those, that three early intervention policies were at least as cost effective in reducing serious crimes as the three strikes policy, with the graduation incentives being well over five times as effective in reducing crime. In summary, if this state is going to return to a solid fiscal foundation anytime in the near future, it's going to have to get much smarter about the way it spends its public safety dollars. And support of this bill would be an appropriate first step. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cynthia Geyer. I'm the mother of two children and the director of a nonprofit organization that works to strengthen and improve the Portland public school system for the 48,000 children that wake up every morning and go to our city's public schools. I am also the victim of a crime who is deeply concerned about public safety. And finally, I'm also nervous. It's actually the first time in my role as a citizen in the state to testify before a legislative committee, so thank you for bearing with me. 8 years ago, after attending a movie at Lode Center with good friends and my husband, we went out for a drink to talk and to our neighborhood restaurant on Northeast Broadway, and it was about 10:30 at night, and everyone at my table and my booth all of a sudden looked at me and said, "Hit the ground." And I was stunned and taken off guard, and I just sat in my seat frozen while my five friends got under the table. And all of a sudden, to my right, I felt a chill, and I saw a body. And I turned just slightly to my right and saw a person with a ski mask, another person in a ski mask over to the right, and a gun to my forehead. He said, "Lady, if you hit the ground, you're going to live." So I got under the table with my friends and proceeded to watch what turned out to be 9 or 10 young people who had gone through a series of armed robberies, 19 counts of armed robbery through Northeast Portland, and the majority of them were students at my neighborhood high school, Grant High School. So that night was incredibly traumatic for me, and has made me hypersensitive to issues of public safety in our communities. And I see an incredible link between the issues you're dealing with today through this bill and my concern about the state's investment in quality public education for all kids in Oregon. It underscored my experience for me, the fact that we must use our tax dollars, which, as John said, are scarce and finite, in Oregon to have the greatest possible effect on crime. I believe, and I think the research that I've seen shows, that public safety is best achieved through a very balanced approach. In Oregon, we are now spending $1.2 billion on corrections, which is a 34% increase from the last biennium. Compare that to the growth in our investment collectively in funding our public schools in the state. 1.7% growth from the last biennium to this biennium with the governor's proposed starting budget. It becomes clear that our priorities, as you look at the way we're allocating scarce resources, need to be called to question. There is no balance. We are dropping in Oregon now to 31 of all states in our investment in public schools and public education. Something must be done to close the growth in corrections and put money back into programs and services that have a track record of preventing crime, like Head Start, strong public education, access to higher education, and prevention and intervention programs for our young people. Senate Bill 435 is a step in the right direction. As an advocate for children and strong public education in Oregon, I urge you to help restore balance to public safety by passing Senate Bill 435 out of your committee today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and welcome to your first testimony before a legislative committee. You did very well. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Pazanski.
Yeah, I'm not sure who on the panel might have this answer. I should have asked probably the representatives that were here first. Looking at the Dash 2 and seeing how this would be effective prospectively, does the court, in the sense, would the judge still have the authority to give a sentence for a non-measure 11 sentence without allowing for any good time to be accumulated, or would this apply to each and every person that would be sentenced under a non-measure 11 offense?
Senator Pazanski, we'll have counsel answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pazanski, I will endeavor to answer you. I would say my opinion is the answer would not prevent the court from denying earned time credit. That may be done by virtue of a separate statute, ORS 137.750, and I don't have that in front of me, but I believe the language is that if the court finds substantial and compelling reasons, it may deny earned time, and that there's nothing in this bill that affects that statute.
Thank you.
Thank you for getting that on the record. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Does the Blakely decision and that whole issue about earned or aggravating factors have to be tried in front of a jury, does that have any effect on a judge being able to say you cannot get earned time unless it's found by a jury?
That is an excellent question, Senator Beyer. Counsel, you want to take a stab at that one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Beyer, again, I'll endeavor to answer. My off-the-cuff response is that that would not have a Blakely impact. And this goes back, I think, Senator Beyer, to a question that you asked me when we were talking about Blakely and the Booker Fanfan case the day or two after the federal court decision applying Blakely was decided. I think that the principle here is that Blakely is implicated if the sentence imposed is greater than the presumptive maximum. And if we're talking about a situation where the actual sentence imposed is going to be the presumptive maximum without an earned time reduction, I would argue that there's no requirement for any findings by the jury.
I think the earned time would qualify as a downward departure rather than having the lack of earned time, but that's a very good question. Are there other questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Senator Burdick, the panel. One of the things missing on this handout we have here, the Oregon State and Local Government Expenditures, is any indication of the savings actually that might be related to crimes and victimization and property tax laws, property losses that did not occur due to the current enforcement and incarceration practices. Do you have any figures on that?
I do not, but referring to the back, again, I think any policy is going to have, is certainly the aspiration is all of our policies have benefits. The K-12 policies have benefits. The transportation ones do as well. The frame of mind that I think you need to work in as you work through this difficult policy decision is, what is the cost effectiveness of our policies moving forward, and are there ways of achieving the same crime reduction goal in a less costly manner? And is this incremental change from your current policy going to, will the benefits outweigh the costs?
If I may, Chair Burdick, Senator Witzit, I do believe there is some data out of Washington State from the Washington Institute for Public Policy that was referred to earlier, which is a bipartisan, legislatively authorized and funded policy institute in Washington State. They have done some significant analysis, not only around that, the number of people recidivating who got the increase in income, but around programs and the cost effectiveness, not only in terms of saving tax dollars, but in the cost of crime reduction and the savings to crime victims. And they looked nationally, not just at Washington State. They look at all of the various programs, whether it's early release, education programs, etc., that have been properly evaluated, and there are more and more of those, and have this cost-benefit analysis. This is what you save. This is what crime victims save. And if you like, I'd be happy to get a copy of that report to you.
I very much would like a copy of that, perhaps for the whole committee, in that I don't believe that we can evaluate the effectiveness on the cost savings unless we know what actually those cost savings are from the standpoint of the people who are the crime victims.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, now we'll move into our next panel with your opponents. Okay, thank you. And the first panel came in just a little bit under 15 minutes, but I will give the second panel a full 15 minutes. And we have Mr. Howard, Steve Dole, Walt Begrow, Bob Herman, John Foote, and Doug Harkelrode are all in this panel. You can come up in any combination. Sorry, Mr. Rodstein, I messed up your name,
Senator Burdick. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will make my comments brief because I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Rodstein. I'd just like to make
yourself.
I'm sorry. Steve Dole with Crime Victims United of Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're here not because we were the pitchers in this situation. We're here because we're the catchers, unfortunately. The crime victims that are in this audience today, and we hope you hear from them after this panel, are compelled to be here by their experiences. I don't believe this is really about the money. I've sat through previous legislatures back in the 90s when they were awash in money, and they've always talked about reducing sentences, cutting sentences, or not increasing sentences. This is about philosophy. This is about ideology. It's not about the money. I can dig you up a study that will tell you just about anything you want. The study you hear about that Mr. Rodstein will address is not peer-reviewed. There's no evidence-based procedures on it. And I might say this about savings. They say this will save $30 million over 4 years. That $30 million represents about two-thirds of what the Salem-Keizer School District has in their reserves of $50 million. And there's about $575 or $80 million in total school reserves. Now, we're not against education. We want kids to get a good education, but we also want those kids to be safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Howard Rodstein. I'm a scientific software developer and a policy analyst for Crime Victims United. We're here today to oppose Senate Bill 435. It would damage the credibility of Oregon's criminal justice system. It would stretch truth in sentencing past the breaking point. It is supported by people making the outlandish claim that they can increase public safety by releasing criminals earlier. They call this smart on crime, but it harkens back to disastrous policies of past decades that brought us devastating victimization. History shows that being tough on crime is smart, and being soft is foolish. From 1995 through 2002, Oregon ranked number one among states in decrease of violent crime rate. Yet during that same period, our property crime rate stayed far above the national average, and we permitted a methamphetamine epidemic to take root and flourish in our state. Deflecting responsibility from criminals and backing off a tough stance will not reduce crime now any more than it has in the past. And in the long run, it will not save money. It is not smart. In the 1990s, the United States Congress passed truth in sentencing legislation that calls for a maximum of 15% earned time. In Oregon, we currently allow 20%. Increasing this to 33% is not truth in sentencing. And that's not to mention 90 days of transitional leave and alternative incarceration programs, which on average reduce sentences by over a year for those eligible. The sentences we are talking about are not long to begin with. 18 months for criminally negligent homicide becomes 12 months after a 33% earned time. That becomes 9 months after 90 days transitional leave. 9 months for criminally negligent homicide is a slap in the face to the surviving family of the victim. Similar arithmetic would apply in the cases of battered women, abused children, home invasion burglary, rape in the third degree, identity theft, and manufacturing and dealing methamphetamine. Credibility is hard to earn and easy to lose. This bill would squander the credibility that we have worked hard to establish. There's been a lot of talk that research shows that increasing earned time causes lower recidivism. This is not the case. We've dealt with this myth for years. It started with a DOC study under former director Dr. Ben DeHaan. I had a long meeting with him on this subject. During that meeting, Dr. DeHaan acknowledged that the study does not provide evidence that increasing earned time causes lower recidivism, but merely that there was an association. There is a vast difference between an association and a cause and effect relationship. Much of science is devoted to making this distinction, but it is completely lacking from the study on recidivism. And our testimony goes into further detail on this. One conclusion of the study is that, quote, the relationship between earned time and recidivism seems to be linear, but we only tested it until 20%. We have no reason to believe that it would not continue, close quote. According to this theory, increasing earned time to 100% for all offenders would cut recidivism to zero. This is absurd on the face of it and illustrates how fundamentally unscientific this study is. We heard the figure of, you hear 32, 33, 34% increase in the DOC budget. The actual increase from the general fund is 33%. This is a factually accurate statement, but it is misleading. As the legislative fiscal budget analysis points out on page 127, almost half of this increase is due to creative financing employed by the previous legislature. And our written testimony goes into greater detail on this. According to DOC, less than one-third of the total increase is due to prison population growth. In the last decade, violent crime in Oregon has plummeted and is now well below the national average, but we still have a property crime wave on our hands, and our state has the sixth highest property crime rate in the country, and we have a methamphetamine epidemic. Imagine having to personally go to a law-abiding citizen who has had their identity stolen and their credit destroyed, or to the family of a 14-year-old child raped by a 30-year-old man, or to the family of a victim who was killed by a drunk driver and telling them that the criminal will serve only two-thirds or less of the sentence. This is the kind of thing that breeds cynicism among people about the criminal justice system. Now advocates for criminals are complaining because we are finally paying for past neglect of public policy. Over time, people forget the lessons of the past and recycle failed policies. We've been there once, and that was enough. We adamantly oppose Senate Bill 435. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County and serve this year as the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We'd like you to know, as district attorneys of Oregon, that this was not our opposition to this bill was not a knee-jerk reaction. There was a lot of discussion through emails, through personal conversations, and committee meetings to evaluate this bill. And nonetheless, all district attorneys have taken the position of opposition to this bill. We're not unaware of the significant financial considerations that this legislative body has to face. We simply believe, bluntly, that the cost to our victims and our citizens far outweighs the savings that would be generated by this bill. Today you have heard and will hear two themes. One, this bill affects the integrity of the system and the truth in sentencing. And secondly, you'll hear the theme of the population of offenders. I think it's important to know what type of offenders we're talking about that get into Oregon prisons. It's important perhaps compare what type of offenders get into Washington prisons, perhaps before they ever get into Oregon prisons. One example I can think of, in Oregon, you can have a DUI diversion, you can have three DUI convictions, and it's not until you get your fourth DUI conviction in a 10-year period that you are even eligible for prison. Under this bill, if the judge, after a sentencing hearing and after deciding there was no reason to reduce the maximum possible sentence, imposed a sentence of 18 months, that five-time DUI offender in a 10-year period would receive 12 months, not counting transitional leave. That sentence is the same sentence the judge could impose if they sent them to the local jail within 12 months, for 12 months on his second or first conviction. That, to me, is an example of the problem with this bill in terms of the integrity of the system. And finally, I would simply say it's important to look at the numbers and look at the people that we deal with every day in the courtroom, know who the victims are and know who these offenders are that are going to Oregon prisons, and the language that we've heard today. By example, if someone were to walk out this door, get punched in the nose, in a local schoolyard, a child was exposed by an indecent exposure, someone dodged the DUI driver down the street, and when you get to your car, you find that it's been broken into and property stolen, it will be little comfort for you to know that under the definition of recidivist, none of those people are recidivists under the Washington definition. And that, I believe, again, speaks to the integrity and the heart of the system. It's important for our citizens to know what a sentence truly means. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is John Foote, and I'm the district attorney in Clackamas County. I've been in this business for about 25 years, and I've had the experience as a prosecutor in the courtroom, as a DA. I was also the Inspector General for the Department of Corrections for 5 years. I was also the Deputy Director of the Department of Corrections for about 6 months. I feel I'm fairly familiar with the operational aspects of corrections. But I also wanted to talk about the experience we had back in the 80s dealing with truth in sentencing and why sentencing guidelines was created. And eventually, I think, why Measure 11 was passed by the voters. It's for the these are the experiences that many of us had in the 80s, which was we would hear one thing in court about what was going to happen to somebody, 20 years in prison, 10 years in prison, 5 years in prison. All the professionals in the courtroom would know that was not true. The person would go down to prison and be released in vastly shorter periods of time. Now, it worked for a while, but eventually what happened was the public lost their trust and faith in what they were hearing and being told. It was a fundamental breach in that relationship. We tried to fix it with sentencing guidelines, and the voters spoke again on Measure 11 because they wanted to hear what was happening and they wanted to see it happen. This bill moves us back to a time when what we're hearing in court is not what's going to happen, and that is a bad thing. We say that because we've lived it. when the trust is lost, it's lost not just by us. You lose it. You lose your ability to do other things that you need to do because the public won't believe what we're doing is what actually happens. So I encourage you not to go back to that time. 20%, Mike Schrunk wrote a letter indicating that he was on the sentencing guidelines process when it was created, and 20% was, after a long debate, was struck as a balance between getting some incentives for inmates but also providing truth in sentencing. It has worked, fundamentally worked. We can live with the 20%. We can explain it to victims. Everybody knows that's the most that can happen. You start on the slippery slope, you change that. It fundamentally, this is a fundamental change. That's why this is not about the numbers. This is about fundamentally changing the system in that way, and we believe it's a mistake because we've lived with that mistake before. Finally, my experience has also taught me that these mechanisms for releasing inmates start out the way this one is starting out. But what happens is they turn into just mechanisms for getting people out of prison early. That's what happened in the 80s when we had indeterminate sentencing and a parole board. It became, quite frankly, something no one believed anymore. We don't want to go that route anymore. These mechanisms to release people really have to be monitored carefully and held accountable. For instance, I just heard today that earn time is now 61%, if I heard this correctly from the folks who were here before, 61% of the inmates now get 20% of the earn time. They get their entire earn time. When I worked in corrections, that was not the way it worked. It just didn't work that way. The overall number I remember was more like 15%. We heard today it's 16 or 17, and if this number, 61%, is correct, it's higher than that. The reason for that is the pressure to release inmates. That's what's going on. That's what will drive the decisions inside the institutions. The employees will do what they're told to do. So please do not take down, don't, please don't go down this road. That's what we're asking. We appreciate your listening to us, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Beglow, you have about 1 minute.
Madam Chair, my colleague Doug Harkerode was going to speak, and I think I'll defer to him to utilize that time. I appreciate the opportunity.
We all know that he can speak very fast.
There's my written testimony. I won't repeat any of those items there. You have a sentencing guideline grid. Oh, pardon me, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkerode. I'm the Lane County District Attorney.
Welcome.
You have a sentencing guideline grid in front of you, each one. I brought those today. Our office publishes these. We sell them statewide. Try to make our cost back. If you understand the grid and can tell me what each and every one of these things is, then you'll understand why 33% is too much. If you do not understand the grid, you can't figure that out except on a policy basis, and I don't have time in my minute to teach that. I would be happy to come back repeatedly to explain this grid to you in great detail. I teach it at the law school 3 times a year. It's important to understand what happens to people under this grid. One person at a time, one crime at a time. Howard did a great job, actually, of mentioning several of those. Okay, recidivism. Claudia Black spoke with her outside afterwards. 25% of the people that are released with earned time, I called it good time in my letter, they reoffend their recidivists under their definition. Their definition is very narrow. It is only felons who have been caught, prosecuted, and convicted. If I got up and walked up and hit one of you today, that would be an assault in the fourth degree. That is a misdemeanor. You would think that that would be a crime that would be counted under their study. It is not. Misdemeanors are not counted in that recidivism study. So we don't know, except at a very low level, that 25% of those people who get out under good time do commit another felony. I'd suggest to you that it's significantly higher, and I suggested to Ms. Black that their next study should add in the misdemeanors so we get some accurate data there about what the real recidivism rate is. I've used more than my minute. I'll just stop there, and thank you.
I really don't want to cut you off. We want to hear what you have to say. So maybe you can respond to this question I have. I think that what we're struggling here is we have, you know, you can go up or down, but we have a finite
number of prison beds available at any given time. And I know in my county, and Mr. Schrunk has written a letter in opposition to this bill, which will be part of the record, but in my county, a lot of people who commit crimes that are maybe below the level that we're talking about here do not have any kind of credible penalty because the prison, the jail beds don't exist, and then you ramp that up. The prison beds don't exist unless we take a lot of money from elsewhere. I think what we're trying to get at, least what I'm trying to get at in this bill, is, you know, do all of these people really need to be occupying these beds for the full time, or would these beds be more productively used for some other people that we would really like to ramp up sentences for and stick them in those beds? That's what we're trying to struggle with here. Not, I mean, I think anybody on the surface of it can argue that, well, if you keep the people, they did a bad thing, they took their chances, and you keep them in there for a very, very long time, yes, you are going to improve public safety. But if there's any way of parsing out some people who you can use some kind of criteria to think that they won't reoffend, or if you have some data, then wouldn't you rather use those beds for something else? That's what we're struggling with here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I'll let the DAs fill in, but I think an important fact that you should consider in this debate is that according to the Criminal Justice Commission in Oregon, 72% of people who commit felony crimes never go to prison. That can kind of start to give you an idea of who we really have in Oregon prisons as opposed to these other states.
Okay, Mr. Foote, I think you were...
I don't want to take Doug's. My answer is very brief. It's a sense of accountability. And you have to have some consequence for behavior, and it has to be proportional to the crime. I think if you're sitting in our seats and looking at the kinds of things that happen to people who commit crime, many of these crimes, the sentences are barely proportional now. That's the problem. And you can talk about studies all the time, all you want. We have a fundamental sense that there has to be a proportional response for the kind of crime that's committed. And if you look at these grids, these sentences are low.
Senator Prusansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got three questions. Gentlemen, please bear with me. I just want to get some stuff on the record, so please don't take anything personal here. Regarding the Dash 2s, they've just been brought to us today, first time for me to hear them. I'm wondering, I guess, Mr. Herman, since you're here as a representative for ODAA, did the district attorneys actually have an opportunity to weigh in on the Dash 2s as to the impact of being prospective versus retro, which I believe is how the bill was originally drafted?
Madam Chair, Senator, we were uncertain, quite frankly, when we discussed this, whether it was retroactive or not, and I can tell you unequivocally, if it were retroactive, that was a huge issue. However, we were under the assumption, and I think as an association, that we didn't know whether they were or not. So there were many, much of the discussion was, even if they were not retroactive, we would have the same issues. It would be less of a truth in sentencing problem than it would be if it's proactive.
Thank you. Mr. Foote, question for you regarding the truth in sentencing. Since we know, and I've wanted upon the record previously as to 137-750, where the judge has to actually say on open court what is going to be the sentence, do you believe that we have truth in sentencing today, since there is, in fact, the opportunity for those that are on non-Measure 11 sentences under the sentencing guidelines to receive up to 20% off of their sentence?
Yes, I think it fundamentally we do have it today. In a perfect world, would the sentence actually be what you hear in court? Yes, sometimes do the victims not hear the 20%? Perhaps. But I think overall it's a good balance when you take into consideration Measure 11 and other kinds of things. I think people have a sense that what's happening. I will tell you, when they do hear it, they're often surprised and disappointed, but at least they're hearing it.
Right. And my last question is for Mr. Rodstein. Mr. Rodstein, your testimony, you started off with the parameter of 1995 through 2002 regarding the decrease in violent crime. In your studies, isn't it true that violent crime was actually going down before 1995? In fact, if the history, if I remember correctly, was showing that it was going down like since 1991 or 1992.
Are you talking about Oregon or the United States?
Oregon.
Okay, now in Oregon, if you look back from 1960 and you go up to 1985, there was a 7.9 times increase in violent crime. It then remained virtually flat for 10 years. And it started, the first actual year of decrease was 1996. Nationally, it started in about 1992. And we often hear this question, well, crime declined all over the United States, so Measure 11 can't be the cause for what happened in Oregon. But one thing that people, first of all, Oregon was number one in decrease in crime from 95 to number to 2002. And secondly, people need to understand that by 1995, every state in the union had some form of mandatory minimum sentencing.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Senator
Whitsitt. Chair Burdick, for anyone on the panel, actually, getting back to the studies that have been brought out here in testimony, statewide, what percent of the felonies are successfully attributed to the perpetrators and subsequently successfully prosecuted? And the second part of the question is, would this percentage also hold true for those crimes that were committed by someone having been released to recidivism?
I can't tell you statewide, but I can tell you nationwide. There's a study called Felony Sentencing 2000, which covers the whole country, and that shows the number of reported crimes and the number of convictions. For each reported rape, for each rape conviction, there are 9 reported rapes. For each robbery conviction, there are 11 reported robberies. And for each reported aggravated assault, there are 11 aggravated assault conviction, there are 11 aggravated assault reports. So the percentage of crimes that are actually successfully prosecuted and convicted is very, very small.
Follow up, please. And in that study, recidivism was defined as being caught and successfully prosecuted. So in your example, perhaps 8 out of 9 of those might not be actually caught and prosecuted. Is that correct?
Well, as a rule of thumb, you can, from those figures, it's a reasonable extrapolation that a large percentage of felony crimes are not, do not result in a conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next, I think we'll go in, I was going to go every other one. I think we'll go in groups of 3 here. Bob Zimmer, Jessica Stevens, and Arwin Bird. We got 4 chairs up here, so why don't we bring up Joe Smith in this group, and then we'll take the next group of 4 as well.
Would you give him my testimony over?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Zimmer. I am here today as a former law enforcement officer and educator to testify in support of Senate Bill 435. In my experience as a police officer, first as a patrolman, and eventually as the operations sergeant of the warrant section in Multnomah County, there were many times when I came into contact with persons who benefited from probation and parole, or in some way were given an opportunity to return to the community as productive people. I'm here to support Senate Bill 435 because I feel that the expanding costs of government and the criminal justice system today make consideration of the bill worthwhile. I do not feel that it is realistic to continue spending on the building of new prisons without exploring other avenues which would cost less and possibly result in lower prison population. One of the main observations that I have made during my time as a police officer and criminal justice educator is the tendency of the public to seek easy and simplistic solutions to problems that often defy easy answers. In my opinion, the criminal justice system has many such issues at every level. This is because the system at each level functions by decision and input from people, and therefore will never be perfect or satisfactory to everyone. many people believe that simply locking people up for the commission of a crime will solve our problem of crime. While this might be a deterrent to some and appropriate to violent and or repeating offenders, I believe that we need to address the issues of those in our system who it might be possible to return as productive people to the community. I feel Senate Bill 435 would aid and encourage those who would like to move in that direction by providing some motivation and a goal for them to work toward. The better the quality of the programs we offer, the more success we would have. In the long run, I feel that this approach would lower the recidivism rate. Finally, I feel that we are introducing a note of caring and optimism, which we claim to value as a society, in trying to assist those who may not have had very many opportunities in their lives to gain a level of success. How we deal with the worst of society, if you will, says something about how we respect each other and our level of concern for the dignity of the individual, our attitude toward our communities, and the quality of life for each citizen in them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bird, we have your written testimony. It's a little bit longer, so if you could summarize it, that'd be great.
Okay. I'll try to do as best possible. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Arwen Bird, and I am here in this particular instance as a survivor of a violent crime and also somebody who's interested in this issue professionally. As you probably know, in 1999, I was one of the co-founders of SAFES, which now has become Crime Survivors for Community Safety. And in 2003, I was one of 9 people in the United States selected by the Open Society Institute for a Justice Advocacy Fellowship. The course of my fellowship will be replicating the work of Crime Survivors for Community Safety in Washington and Nevada. I'm here today representing Crime Survivors for Community Safety, and then also would like to share some of my personal views on the proposal before you. My advocacy for survivors of crime and violence stems from my own experience as a survivor. In 1993, my sister and I were rear-ended by a man who was later convicted of drunk driving and second-degree assault. The crash paralyzed me and gave my sister a mild traumatic head injury. Our injuries continue to have an effect on both my sister and my quality of life and have deepened my understanding of the long-term effects of crime and violence. Needless to say, the crash was life-changing for me and provides the foundation for my advocacy. I don't want another person to be hurt as my sister and I were, and I'm working to create a criminal justice system that both helps survivors and communities heal from harm, as well as prevents future victimization. I see this particular policy change in the context of a larger criminal justice system that works diligently and efficiently to prevent future victimization. The changes described in this bill would increase the amount of time that a person would earn off of their sentence. More importantly, it helps to hone the tools that our criminal justice system uses to return former prisoners to their communities, able to contribute positively rather than perpetuating harm or violence in their neighborhoods. As you're probably aware, the Department of Corrections research shows that increasing incentives and access to treatment, literacy, and other educational programs directly correlates to reduced recidivism. As an advocate for survivors of crime and violence, when I hear reduced recidivism, I think of the hundreds, perhaps thousands, or fewer victims that will be spared because of policy changes like this. When people who are incarcerated have access to the tools needed to make good choices and positive contributions once they transition back into the communities, the people who live in these communities, many of whom are crime and violence survivors like me, will benefit. The silver lining in this proposal is that it will save millions in badly needed funding, money that could be diverted to meeting the needs of survivors and communities affected by violence through well-funded education, health services, and housing programs. The more time I spend with survivors of crime and violence working to help them piece their lives back together after victimization, the more I feel passionately about the need for stable housing, food, and employment opportunities in our communities. Because crime is life-changing for survivors, it affects not just our physical or emotional health, but also our ability to work and participate in the life in our communities. Mm-hmm. Our justice system addresses just one aspect of the healing process for crime and violence survivors, and unfortunately exists in the context of inadequate resources and services. You have a golden opportunity here to provide the resources to the broader safety net of healthcare, education, and housing for survivors by passing this legislation that will both prevent future victimization and save taxpayer dollars. I'd like to thank you for listening to my testimony and would like to add a little bit beyond what I have written today, just to address a little bit of the discussion earlier about accountability. As a violence survivor, I'd like for all of us to maybe think a little bit on a more substantive level about what accountability is. Because for me as a violence survivor, I want to know that the person who hurt me is not going to do that again. That, for me, is accountability. It's not a, I don't think it's a magic number in terms of 5 years in prison, 10 years in prison, 15 years in prison. It's more what is the real goal that we're trying to get to as a society, you as senators, able to make decisions about the policies that will help create that safe society. And would like for you to hold that goal of creating public safety and preventing future victimization in your minds as you're making these decisions. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens. I'm co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. HSCO is a broad coalition of advocates for human services policy and funding. Our coalition strongly supports extending earned time for these non-Measure 11 inmates. As we all know, the legislature is struggling to adequately fund all public services to preserve the Oregon we all believe in. The savings achieved by this bill could get us a lot closer. In the near future, we will continue to struggle to fund programs that can be significant deterrents to increasing our Oregon prison population. We know that the likelihood of becoming a DOC inmate increases dramatically for people who grow up in our child welfare system. The $16 million that at least could be achieved in savings from this measure could provide employment support and stability for 600 very low-income families and meet the specific needs of 1,000 children a month in our child welfare system through our system of care, and allow 600 more families to keep children with their grandparents or aunts and uncles or other relatives when they can't live with their parents, and have money left over. Just to be clear, our position is not to take money out of necessary public safety services, but the goal of the human services advocacy community is to fight for a better Oregon, an Oregon with less crime. This bill would help us on that mission. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have my written testimony. I may have missed my opportunity.
Fine. It'll be delivered. Thank you. Welcome.
I'll try to abbreviate my comments further. My name is Joe Smith. I'm founder and president of Joe Smith Associates, a business leadership and development company. I'm also a former president of the Portland State University Alumni Association and a supporter of higher education. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 435 because I'm convinced that we, the public, benefit more from preventing crime through education and rehabilitation than we do from warehousing prisoners. The currently proposed budget represents approximately a 32% increase over the previous biennium. At the same time that we are increasing monies to corrections, we are cutting funding to proven prevention and intervention programs for young people, in spite of the fact that one of the most effective ways to prevent crime is to prevent at-youth risk from becoming criminals. Senate Bill 435 makes sense because it will make additional funds available for childhood intervention and prevention programs, and it will provide incentives for those who are already incarcerated to behave, to rehabilitate, and successfully reenter society. While spending 4 years working with former offenders in Clark County, Washington, I was stunned to find out just how many, firsthand, to find out how many have incarcerated parents and siblings in other institutions. We must break the cycle of crime through early prevention, education, and rehabilitation, if not for those offenders and their families, then for our own safety. I urge the committee to pass Senate Bill 435 and help restore funding to prevention programs and education in Oregon. Thank you for your work, and thank you for making me welcome here today.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. This panel came in about 2.5 minutes each person, which is pretty good. So we will have four people come up from the other side now. Pete Shepard, Janice Itura, Mark McDonald, and John Bradley. Uh-oh, sentencing guidelines, I can see them. Thank you. Right. Welcome to the committee. If you could hold your comments to 2.5-3 minutes each, that would be great. Well, we should be able to make it to everyone. Welcome.
Go ahead. Well, everybody's pointing to me, so I'm Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Attorney General Hardy Myers is attending a meeting, a statewide conference of his sexual assault task force in Eugene today, and so he asked me to specifically convey his apologies to the committee. I've submitted to you his written testimony, however, and in light of the time and the constraints on the committee, I won't read the whole thing. But I do want to point out that the Attorney General's history with this issue goes back at least to 1987, when he was appointed to chair the council that ultimately produced the sentencing guidelines, which Mr. McDonald and Mr. Bradley are prepared to teach to you in our 15 minutes of fame, I guess. And prior to the sentencing guidelines that Attorney General Myers helped craft, the system suffered from a multiplicity of defects, some of which are detailed in the Attorney General's written statement. Now, from that statement and from my own experience as a prosecutor in that system prior to the adoption of the sentencing guidelines, I want to spend my 2.5 minutes focusing on the difference between the sentence imposed in the trial court and the sentence actually served, the sentence of incarceration actually served. Before the guidelines, all of us inside of the system daily engaged in a charade. In plea negotiations, the prosecutor would offer X years of imprisonment on a given charge in exchange for a plea, knowing that that offer meant very little in the final analysis of how long that offender would serve. The defense attorney would recommend a plea of less than X to her client, knowing that the negotiated reduction actually meant next to nothing for her client in terms of how long the client would serve. In court, and sometimes in the presence of victims observing the proceedings, and always in the view of the public, the trial judge would accept the plea agreement, sometimes express the hope that the defendant would be incarcerated for the full term, and then execute a judgment that outwardly seemed to define the term of imprisonment, but actually did not establish the length of sentence to be served. The integrity of the system itself was undermined by the yawning gap between the imposed sentence and the time actually served. It was in part to attain truth in sentencing that the council chaired by the Attorney General recommended the legislature that the legislature authorize a reduction of 20% in the time of imprisonment actually to be served. The council made that judgment and that conclusion based upon a careful evaluation of the competing public policies in relation to that issue. The council concluded that a potential imprisonment reduction of that amount would still leave the length of sentence and of time actually served reasonably close. The Assembly adopted that judgment, and the resulting policy was codified as the statute that Senate Bill 435 would amend. Senate Bill 435, by increasing the potential reduction in the actual length of imprisonment under a given sentence from 20% to 33%, would represent a major weakening of our truth in sentencing commitment that is part of the guidelines policy foundation. The Attorney General respectfully urges you to defend that standard and to reject the change proposed in Senate Bill 435.
Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome, Madam Chair,
And committee, I'm Janice Aitura, and I'm just a mom from Eugene, Oregon, and I would like you to oppose Senate Bill 435 for reasons that I'll give you. My son was murdered in October 3rd, 1994, which is pre-Measure 11. So the people that committed this murder were under the sentencing guidelines. The accomplice and the shooter broke into my home at 1:30 in the morning and shot my son at point blank in the back of the head in his own bedroom. The accomplice got 10 years, served 8. The shooter got 16, which means he'll serve 12 and maybe 8 months. That's with a 20% reduction. Mary Louise Thompson, who is the mastermind behind Aaron's murder, was charged with aggravated murder and other consecutive charges, and she was sentenced without life with any chance of parole, July 23, 1996. January 28, 2002, Mary Thompson won her appeal, which she was resentenced to 25 years with the possibility of parole. Because Aaron was just going to be a witness in a juvenile crime. He was 18 years old, a senior at Willamette High School. Mary was probably 44, 45 years old, but the witnessing that Aaron was going to do was a juvenile crime, which was a cutting between her son at 16 and a 14-year-old kid. And so the sentencing that she received through criminal court was found guilty, was reduced because it was a juvenile crime at the time. And with that 20% for the 25 years in 2002, she will serve 20 with a chance of parole. By passing sub-bill 435 and increasing the time credit earned to 33%, Mary Thompson will only serve 16 and a half years with the possibility of parole. My family and I have already been victimized by the system, because if this was a pre-Measure 11 sentencing, these would have got 25 years with probably no questions asked. And we have already tried to get our lives back together. I have two daughters that have tried to commit suicide twice because of this crime, because I'm a single mom of for 21 years of these five children, and we had nowhere to go with this pain. And for you to vote yes on sub-bill 435 would, again, reopen all these pains, all these emotions, and just make our life a living hell all over again. You have to understand that I still live in the same house that he was shot in. I live in the same neighborhood, and these boys will, and Mary Thompson, will all be released to the same area. So the fear escalates, knowing that they could be out in a matter of 16 years. And to let you know that the shooter that shot my son, if this were to pass, would almost be released immediately, because that would his 33% would be up. So I just want you to hear my voice and know that the fear and the pain that would be subjected to me and my family is enormous. I just want you to understand and vote no, because there's no amount of dollars that could be attached to my son's murder to make these murderers be released okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I suspect this would not change your opinion on the bill any, but we do have an amendment to make it not apply to anything that is already in the system, any sentence that's already been imposed. So from your personal standpoint, this would not have an impact on the situation you described.
No.
And like I say, I suspect it doesn't have any effect on your position, but
right.
I want you to know that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, you asked the question I was going to ask, and I want to thank Mr. Torre for testifying. I remember the case well, and I'm sorry for your son's loss, and that was going to be my question, if that would change your mind in any way about
absolutely
that.
Not.
I can see that.
And thank you for hearing me.
And I appreciate your
testimony.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Bradley. I'm the special counsel to District Attorney Michael Schrunk. You have his letter. I don't think that there's anything in this letter that hasn't already been said. And on his last paragraph, the amendment that you've offered would make that irrelevant to this. I just want to say a couple things before I turn it over to Mark McDonald. Last year, I participated in the corrections grand jury in Multnomah County. And what that corrections grand jury does is we look at, the institution and the conditions of the institutions. As you're aware, and as the chair said, Multnomah County does have inadequate jail beds, not space. And as a result, the sheriff of Multnomah County has had to release people. And what he does is he uses a matrix system where he concludes these are the least dangerous people, and these are the people he releases. During the time the sheriff has done this, property crimes specifically, car thefts and some of your identity thefts, have gone up tremendously. The other thing that's gone up tremendously is the use of the arrest of methamphetamine, but also the belief the use of methamphetamine. That by just releasing people, and the opposition we have to this bill is that the corrections division will use this as a release mechanism, as they've done this in the past. But if they're just going to release people, the consequence is going to be greater crime. I don't think anybody would disagree with what the chair said. It would be great to find a way in which to find a system where someone doesn't need to be in jail, and you know the person isn't going to commit another crime, is to let that person out. But I don't think this is the vehicle. Two unintended consequences. One is, somebody mentioned Blakely. One of the things that may be happening already and that you may not even know about, maybe you want to ask the analysts to look at it, is my guess is because of Blakely, certainly in Multnomah County, the number of departures have fallen to almost flat. And even with the Blakely fix, there are not going to be that many departures. And the question is how does that factor into what kind of savings is that to the state? I think it's something you need to look at. The second thing is this. Right now, it's a 20% off the good time. If you raise it to 33%, I'm looking at myself as a prosecutor, and I would say this, at 20%, you generally live with that. But as you start raising it to 33% or to 50%, what happens is with every percent you raise that, you're going to have more prosecutors objecting to any good time. And the result could be is by raising it to 33%, and if prosecutors uniformly start saying that's too much, do you have the possibility that you will have less space as a result of this? And again, I'm not saying I have the answer to that. I'm just saying it has the possibility of unintended consequences. But with that, I know we're limited with our time. I'll hand it over to Mr.
Just a real quick question. Do you read this bill to preclude, for example, a prosecutor asking for a limitation on earned time if earned time was available?
In other words, if you said 33.5%, now, sure.
That would be the maximum. Do you see anything in here that would stop you as a prosecutor from not opposing all earned time, but opposing the full amount or proposing a cap?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just don't know that you can limit it to just. I think you either have to say you're objecting to earned time, or I don't think you can say maybe Mr. Shepherd have a better idea.
Madam Chair, I can look at the statute and try to answer wrong.
That would be a useful thing for us to consider as we look at this bill. Welcome, Mr. McDonald.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm Senior Deputy District Attorney with Multnomah County. I'm in charge of our drug unit. I've been in charge of the drug unit for 7 or 8 years. It's sort of interesting. I independently thought of the same thing that Mr. Bradley did, is that unintended consequences of this may be more trials, more convictions, because the reality is that with most of these property offenders, drug offenders, people, we're dealing with multiple charges. And I know in my own situation, I might require a defendant to plead to more charges or more time to make up for the difference in what I think that they might get with good time or earned time. So, it could end up costing more. What I primarily wanted to talk about though today was about sentencing guidelines 3, if you have that. Just a brief explanation. Each crime is given a classification rating 1 through 11, rather the most serious, 1 the least serious. And then the other major factor is the defense criminal history, and somebody with no prior convictions, somebody with an A.
They are familiar with the sentencing guidelines, so if you could
I was going to.
Okay, great.
But I just
want
to point out, in Oregon, actually, it's hard for particularly drug offenders to get to prison. I always say you got to work to get to prison on a drug offense for mere possession.
Ms. McDonald, I think you need to move to your microphone.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Mere possession, despite the number of convictions that you that you have, it could be one or 100. It's still going to be presumptive probation, and the court is prohibited from departing to prison. So it's causing a real problem with repeat offenders, especially for those people who are trying to run drug courts, because there's really no incentive for those people to participate. For straight methamphetamine manufacturing, it's a level 4. Even with a person who has 4 prior methamphetamine manufacturing convictions, it's still presumptive probation. The same as with street-level drug dealers. On your 4th conviction, it's still presumptive probation. Not until your 5th conviction do you even have the possibility of a prison sentence without upward departure. So, and the same is true with identity theft. Straight identity theft without any aggravating factors is a 2. It has to be over $10,000 to get up to a level 5, but even with multiple convictions, it's still presumptive probation. The bottom line is that Oregon has a very modest, if not very lenient, sentencing system. So this bill even undercuts that even more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Brzezinski.
Madam Chair, a question for the Multnomah County DAs. I see that my district attorney is back there. I guess I'd need to ask, did you get permission to actually reprint that?
I did.
Okay, because if you didn't, I was going to say the cost for that being that big was probably going to be about 10 times as much as what it's costing. And Doug needs to pay for that.
We won't tell you when we got this.
Okay, one other question, if I could.
Please.
Just for the record, I mean, the buzzwords here in this capital right now is methamphetamine's identity theft, and something that we take very seriously and we're working on. There's over 70 bills dealing with meth in some component. I mean, the reality is not just Oregon that has this problem. I just want to make sure everyone understands that we're not the only state that has this exponential explosion. It's across the country, and finally it's now gotten, unfortunately, back to the East Coast, and we're seeing at the federal level where they're actually looking at trying to do something, where I think some of the western states have been working on it, but it's now to a more heightened other level.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I understand the question that you asked earlier, you were inquiring as to whether it was possible for the court to permit upon sentencing, for example, I'll allow you to have 17% earned time. And I have to say that the face of the statute doesn't seem clearly to answer the question of whether that authority exists. It's one way to read 137.750 is that it requires the court to make effectively an on or off decision. And I can't answer the question that you've asked based on the face of the statute.
But there wouldn't be any obstacle to our putting it in, that they had that discretion to cap the earned time.
I can't think of any constitutional prohibition that would prevent the Assembly from making that choice.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Sorry to rush you through here. Okay. Now we will have, we're going to go, we've got another committee that has most of us on it, so I'm going to stick through here for about another 15, 20 minutes.
And Madam Chair, I can just say for my committee members, we will probably be starting a little bit late. I'm going to go get coordinated, but if you get there 20 after, 25 after, that's fine. We're just doing public hearings, so don't rush if you
Great.
Want to stay.
Thank you. Next, we will take Tom Fay, William Robinson, and Paul Solomon. Welcome. And we are, again, I hate to sound like a broken record, we're running short of time, and so the more succinct you can be, the more it will be appreciated. Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Fahey.
I'm a volunteer president of Portland Community College Foundation. I'm here today representing the Oregon Community College Association in favor of Senate Bill 435. The Oregon Community College Association, which represents all 17 of Oregon's community colleges and over 330,000 Oregonians, knows there's a direct relationship between the attainment of a post-secondary education and lower rates of unemployment, less reliance on public assistance, increases in public safety, and greater contributions to the state economy. Budget constraints over the last few years have forced colleges to eliminate all but the most elemental programs. These are not the range of services needed by the population under discussion here today. Community colleges believe that Senate Bill 435 takes the necessary first steps to free monies needed to support education, as well as provide the opportunity to reduce the recidivism rate in Oregon. With adequate funding, community colleges could provide programming that offers these students a fresh start with the appropriate tools for a productive life. Public safety is the only public service in Oregon that receives increased funding each biennium by constitutional mandate. As a result, the portion of general fund dollars allotted for corrections has increased from 6% over a decade ago to 10% today. At the same time, funding from community colleges has rapidly declined. Since 2001, community colleges have experienced a decrease in state funding of $51.3 million. As a result, over 70,000 Oregonians have been denied access to community colleges due to increases in tuition and reductions to programs and class offerings. Community colleges strongly value public safety in Oregon, but believe that communities should not be forced to choose between public safety for their families and education. Oregon is in the process of revolutionizing education from K through 12 through college. As the conversation progresses, it is essential that those students with non-traditional experiences are included in this discussion if we are to ensure that all Oregonians have a chance at success. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Mr. Solomon.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Solomon. I'm the Director of Men's Services at Sponsors Incorporated in Eugene. Sponsors has been providing reentry services to ex-offenders in Lane County for the past 30 years. I'm here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 435. Earn good time makes sense. As a former federal and state prisoner, I can tell you how much it means to earn good time. While in prison, I marked the days off my calendar, counting down to the day I would eventually be released. The opportunity to reduce my sentence by one day made a world of difference in the way I behaved. It offered me incentive. I engaged in productive, self-enhancing programs in education. This incentive motivated me to pursue available academic endeavors, which ultimately led me to graduate with honors from the University of Oregon. It is time for the state to rein in the spiraling cost of corrections with policy that makes sense for all Oregonians. We can promote public safety by releasing offenders who have completed cognitive restructuring classes. These courses have been proven to reduce recidivism and the cost of reincarceration. Earn Good Time has the potential to reduce prison violence by offering an incentive for nonviolence. Earn Good Time provides a catalyst for positive change. Much has been made of Oregon's movement to require programs to utilize evidence-based best practices where applicable. We have empirical evidence showing that there is no correlation between longer sentences and reduced rates of reoffending. If the benefit of long-term incarceration is simply retribution, we need to take a hard look at the cost of keeping prisoners in custody. Conversely, research indicates that earned good time actually reduces recidivism. How can we afford not to enact sensible legislation that reduces the cost of corrections as well as future crime? Other state governments have made important modifications to their corrections policy, reflecting a nationwide trend toward more reasonable and fiscally responsible approaches in handling prisoners. By overwhelming majorities in both chambers, the state of Washington last year passed legislation mandating the immediate implementation of increased good time. We have a prison system that is bulging at the seams and shows no end in sight. Governor Kulongoski has asked us to support reductions to prison programs, including drug treatment, cognitive programs, and education that will only yield meager savings. A more effective means of decreasing costs is to reduce the number of people in prison. With fewer individuals incarcerated, we can use funds for needed programming as well as education, health care, and social services. Senate Bill 435 does exactly that and provides a safe, sensible solution to the prison crisis in our state. As a service provider to ex-offenders, a taxpayer, a father, and a constituent, I urge you to support Senate Bill 435. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is William Robinson, a former offender. I'm here today to tell you that earned time gave me the incentive to change my life, and I believe it's done the same thing for others. I believe that expanding earned time will help to focus on targeting our resources to locking up the worst criminals. I believe in Measure 11, and that's precisely why we must pass Senate Bill 435, so that we can focus on the dangerous offenders. One of the great things about earned time is that those who don't earn it have to serve every single day of their sentence. Those who don't go through treatment, those who don't get an education, those who assault corrections officers have to serve every single day of their sentence. I was a cocaine dealer on the streets of Northeast Portland. When I was sent to prison, it made me reflect on where my life was heading. I wanted to get out of prison. I was willing to do whatever it took. I started dabbling in treatment, only partly seriously. But in time, I came to see treatment as a way to make the changes I need to make in my life. Now, and to make a long story short, recovery just happened for me. I have 3 years outside of any institution, and I'm really grateful for that. I'm actually grateful to the correction system. Earned time worked for me and created an incentive to make a change in my life. I believe it works for others. Expanding earned time to 33% will increase its effectiveness. I urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 435. I'd like to also add that without the programs, I wouldn't have been able to be introduced to change. And that's what the programs did for me. It gave me an opportunity to reevaluate and think differently. And you know, you lock people up, and if there's no change mechanism, if there's nothing there to get them to look at their lives differently, they will come out and revisit the same exact life they were dealing with before they went in. So it's imperative that we have these programs and these opportunities for people to change. That's what this is really all about. Thank you.
Thank you, and congratulations on your successful turning your life around, both of you. Thank you. Are there questions, Senator Whitsitt, since we're the last remaining soldiers here? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, next we will take Lewis Dice, Cynthia Boyd, and Krista. Welcome. Who would like to start?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Janelle Factor Whipper. I'm a deputy district attorney at Washington County. I am here as a representative of the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
But we did not call you up. We called three other people.
Sorry, Senator. Chair Burdick, I am here with a victim, and she has asked me to be up here with her.
Okay. Did you wish not to speak at all?
No, I'll be speaking.
Okay. We really want to hear from the people who signed up. So
I don't plan to have any statements, Chair Burdick. I am just merely here to introduce the victim's daughter in this case.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Verla Stice, and I'm here to represent my 89-year-old mother. My mother had a severe stroke when she was 87, and that led to a hospital stay and whether she was going to even continue living. From there, we went to a nursing home for rehabilitation, and then we had to decide what would be a safe an environment that could well care for her with her paralyzation from the stroke. We chose an adult foster care in Oregon, close by my home. I visited her several times a day and several times a week. During this time, she was sexually abused by her caregiver. And when we talked to my mother about it and she was able to tell us about the incident, she said, as a victim, she just had to lay there and take it because she had no way of moving. She was paralyzed from the stroke. This caregiver, when we brought it to the attention of the state, they let us know that there was a report that he had been accused of attempted rape earlier that year from an older woman also that was in foster care. She was not believed because she had dementia and Alzheimer's. And the problem is these victims are old with health problems and nobody believes them. When I sat through the court testimony for my mother, there was all kinds of expert testimony going on with doctors and people that were expert with older elders, and they said that there wasn't even a case at that time that had been reported that was true, because elderly people have health issues that cause them to act out this way and accuse people that it is not the truth. There's elderly victims that aren't believed because of their health issues, but if this particular person got out of jail early, he would go back to abusing these type of people because they have no one to depend upon.
Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate hearing what you have to say. Thank you. Would you like to speak next?
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Krista Loveland, and I am the founder and director of a nonprofit agency located in the rural community of Cottage Grove. We work one-on-one with victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault and other violent offenses.
I believe that we saw you when the Commerce Committee was down there for a hearing. Did you testify then as well?
No.
At the high school?
No, I was not at that forum. The one that Senator Pizan was at. Yeah,
right.
I wanted to be at that, but I had to be at another meeting.
Oh, okay.
So I was there in spirit. But
okay, I don't mean to distract you.
Yeah. So WENS is a private nonprofit agency that's dedicated to strengthening families and helping survivors in the aftermath of their abuse. And we work every day with women that are trying desperately to put the pieces of their lives back in order, to raise their families, to work, to try to support themselves. And I can't tell you, I'm personally a survivor of violent assault and rape, so I know it from a first-hand experience. That's why I've dedicated my life to helping others through that process. And I can't emphasize enough how devastating it is when a victim is trying to put back the shattered pieces of their life and they're in a fragile state and they suddenly hear that the perpetrator of their crime is going to be released early for good time or half time or whatever they call it. It's devastating. It sets back their therapeutic processes. It sets back their ability to function as a productive member of society. It triggers their post-traumatic stress and it prevents them from parenting their children. Oftentimes women have to leave the home that they've rebuilt in order to stay safe once they hear the perpetrator is being released early. And it might not seem like a long time, you know, to add or subtract a couple of months, but in the healing process of a survivor, every day is an enormous benefit to them, knowing that they can rest at night, that they can sleep, that they cannot have to look over their shoulder every minute of the day and night, wondering or not if they're going to be attacked again. And it's a very, I feel very honored to be in the position to help women through that process. And as far as costs go, I don't think you can put a price tag on the healing of women and children. I don't think that we can emphasize enough that the importance of parenting our children and what that job is. We know now, and I'm 100% behind early intervention and prevention. I'm dedicated to that with a passion and all the programs that support it. That's the very premise that WENS is built on. We help with a variety of situations, including education and prevention and intervention. We're a private foundation, but we can see that the devastating effects of having perpetrators released early. It's also a psychological effect because already the sentences that are imposed for child rape, domestic violence, and violent assault on women and children are not actually the sentences that we as victims would really feel are appropriate for those crimes. So when you talk about reducing those, then, you know, it's like a slap in the face, and it's also devastating to the healing processes of those trying desperately to rebuild their lives. And one day, 1 hour, 1 minute longer of someone being locked up for the crime that they committed against them can actually be very beneficial for the whole family of victims of crimes. So I want to urge you to think about that and think about the hidden costs that are involved when a woman suddenly is incapable of providing for her family. She may be the only support left for her family if the perpetrator of her violent crime happens to have been her intimate partner or her husband. That's leaving her as the sole provider, not only financially for her children, but emotionally as well. And I can't tell you, I can't emphasize the effects of post-traumatic stress and how strong they are and what it does to a person when they hear that that release date is coming up, even if it has been a sufficient time. So when you start to talk about reducing that time, it's very near and dear to my heart, and I have a lot of strong feelings about that. We provide clients with everything from food to clothing to shelter to basic necessities as well as education. But the biggest thing that we provide, and to me the most important one, is hope for their future. And when their time is cut short on perpetrators of violent crime, it's really hard for us to say, you're going to be okay when you get through this, when you know, they may have to leave the next day because their whole life is shattered again. And that really does happen quite a bit. The hidden cost of a woman having to rely on the state, children, actually, I've seen parents not able to withstand the pressure of knowing the perpetrator is going to be released. If children go into foster care, it's extremely expensive. And how can we pay for a next generation that may suddenly not have gotten the nurturing and the parenting that they needed? They're the victims as much as anything. And we also work with children that are victims of child rape. And I can't tell you how delicate that healing process is and what happens when that time is cut short. So there's hidden cost. It's not going to save money. This bill will not. It might seem like it on the outside in the beginning, but when you look further down the line at the cost that it really takes on to the state and to society at large, there will be no money saved and a lot of tears shed. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming, and thanks for the work you do.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To the committee.
Hi. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cynthia Boyd. I'm a mother of two and a registered nurse. I oppose Senate Bill 435. On June 9th this past year, I was at a red light when I was rear-ended by a criminal. He was driving about 70 miles per hour. And left 300-foot skid marks prior to colliding with my car and totaling it. He was in a stolen car. He fled the scene and on foot and was later caught at gunpoint. I was 34 weeks pregnant at the time of the accident and began having contractions every 3 minutes for about 12 hours. I was rushed to OHSU, sirens blaring, and they were concerned that I was going to deliver the baby before I even made it to the hospital. The ambulance crew was very nervous, sweating. Being a nurse, I recognized this. Contractions were more painful than they were when I delivered the baby 7 weeks later without an epidural. Extremely painful.
Was your baby okay?
Yes, he is.
Oh, thank you.
Now. So contractions went on for about 12 hours every 3 minutes. I got to have a multitude of nice, fun exams to make sure I wasn't going into labor. And the doctors were amazed that I did not deliver the baby at that time. I actually carried him for 7 more weeks. I was very sore. I had multiple bruises across my abdomen. I was unable to dress myself for several days afterwards or care for my 3-year-old. And they weren't sure if the baby would be okay till he was born. Let's see. And there was always a risk of placental abruption where the placenta tore away from the uterus. And fortunately, I delivered a healthy baby boy July 29th. The guy who hit me was charged with 5 counts of 5 counts, including felony hit and run.
anyhow, I do not want to see this man getting out of prison early.
I really appreciate you coming, and what a blessing that your son was okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I had my baby at OHSU, too.
Oh, cool.
Under less traumatic circumstances.
That's good.
Thank you very much. Ms. Sandra Witzit, did you have any questions or comments?
No, I don't.
Thank you very much. We are going to close this hearing now. Appreciate everybody who has come here. Apologize to those we were not able to get to. And the hearing is closed. And Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Well, I thought we were going to do some business.
Huh?